like I love food and I love to eat. I care about food. So like if I have a craving for something, often like finishing a really long training run in a remote area, there's not going to be a lot of food options available. So like dinner might be like a slice of pizza or whatever.
Welcome to the Eat for Endurance podcast. My name is Claire Shorenstein and I'm a registered dietitian and running coach based in New York City. My goal for this podcast, aside from having fun, of course, is to demonstrate that there is no one-size-fits-all style of eating. Rather, there are many different pathways towards individualized health and sports performance. I explore this in my athlete nutrition profiles, as well as in interviews with fellow dietitians on their areas of expertise. Welcome to episode 45 of the Eat for Endurance podcast. Today, I welcome my guest, Veronica Leeds, an ultra runner, a mom, and a former private client of mine, actually. We worked together back in 2018 on her nutrition, back when she was quite new to ultra running. And it was only about, I don't know, a month ago, she came across my Instagram feed, I think it was in late August, as a feature by Ultra Running Magazine, after she finished Eastern States 100 miler, sixth place female. And I thought, oh my God, I know her. It's my client, Veronica. And I read about all of her accomplishments since we last met over the years. You know, she is now finishing top 10 or even winning many of the races that she's doing. She's clearly crushing it. She is training at a whole new level. And I thought to myself, I must get her on the show. She's such a wonderful, sweet, down-to-earth person to talk to. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I think you will as well. Super relatable, a lot of what she's talking about. So without further ado, please enjoy my interview with Veronica Leeds.
Hi, Veronica. Welcome to the Eat for Endurance podcast. How are you doing?
I'm feeling good. I'm excited awesome. To chat with you for the first time in a while.
Yeah, it's been so long since we last talked, and a ton has happened for you, especially as an athlete, and, you know, I'm just so excited to hear all about it today. But, you know, you said you're a listener of my podcast, which is so fantastic, but so you know kind of like how these nutrition athlete profiles tend to go, although they take very circuitous routes sometimes. But before we dive into your nutrition routes, my goodness, we need to talk about what just happened. You got into like a crazy bike crash. And, you know, you had mentioned it in passing when we booked this call not that long ago. I think it was like a month ago or something. But I didn't realize the severity of it until you emailed me last week that you suffered a major traumatic brain injury. And you gave me this like beautiful, crazy, intense description of what happened, which was just wow. So first, I'm just so grateful you're okay. And second, how is recovery going?
Oh, thank you. I wrote that a few days after because I wanted to kind of preserve the memory of it in my mind. And it was pretty raw. So thank you for reading it and just the reaction. And recovery has been actually so much easier and less painless than I had originally anticipated. I haven't had any of the post-concussive stuff like headaches or dizziness or visual disturbances, all the sort of big stuff that they warned about, I luckily have not experienced. That being said, there's definitely some delays with things like word recall or certain weird aspects of short-term memory, just like little things that I'm having to kind of relearn or remember.
Yeah. I mean, would you mind just kind of describing what happened, just so people know the context?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I was about a week out from running Eastern States, and I was spending more time on the bike naturally, just as, you know, sort of an easy recovery modality. And we had just moved back to New Hampshire where we live for the summers. And I had taken my bike to a bike path and I forgot my helmet. And I use the bike for transportation. I didn't own a car for years. I like love the bike, feel super comfortable on it. And I can't think of one other instance that I haven't worn a helmet. But I just thought, you know what, whatever, it's the bike path, so there are no cars and it's not a big deal. And then like I sort of came to like 2.5 hours later. There's maybe a 30-minute period of amnesia. But so I went for a ride. And towards the end, I just lost control, went off of the pavement. When I came to steer back on, I just kind of went flying and hit my head. And I woke up on the phone with a friend asking him if we had run Eastern States.
And that's, by the way, for my listeners, Eastern States 100 miler, where you play sixth female, just again, for more context, right?
Yeah. But yeah, it was, I mean, it was pretty bad. I ended up, I had 5 skull and facial fractures and 3 brain hemorrhages.
Oh, man.
You know, spent a couple of days in a couple different hospitals. But thankfully, I didn't need neurosurgery, and I felt like I was taken really well, you know, really good care of, and, you know, sent home and kind of just recovering slowly.
Wow. That's craziness. I mean, do you have any sense of like what led you to lose control of the bike?
So it would almost be a more satisfying psychologically if there had been a thing that had provoked.
Yeah.
Me.
Yeah.
I remember the second before and there was nothing. It was just, you know, it's just this beautiful, smooth paved bike path. There were no animals. There were no kids. There were no other bikers. And I just sort of I was going downhill. It was like a very low grade downhill. I was going about 20 miles per hour. And I just kind of lost a teeny bit of control and went just a few inches to the side.
Oh, yeah. Crazy. Well, again, I'm so glad you're okay. And what
Thank
a scary
you.
Experience. And I mean, I kind of wonder in some ways if the fact that you had just run Eastern States, and, you know, we'll kind of get into that too. I know it wasn't quite the race you had wanted, but, you know, 100 miles isn't nothing. That's a huge, huge effort. And I wonder if that played into it all, just the fact that you're kind of recovering from that mentally, physically. Maybe not. Maybe this was just like a fluke thing. But,
you know,
I don't know.
I'm sure it did. So I ran Eastern States, and then it just so happened that the next weekend was a backyard race that I kind of helped set up, and it was 10 minutes from our house. So I stayed up all night and I did the AC and it was so much fun. But, you know, like I'm up all night doing that and drinking, and like that's the second week in a row losing a full night of sleep. That was 2 nights before the accident, I guess. And then came home and did like a recovery run, and it was, you know, maybe hour 2 on the bike, and hadn't it was at such a low intensity that I wasn't fueling on the bike, but I'm sure it was just a combination. It was just like my body saying, it's
yeah,
to take a rest, girlfriend.
You know? Yeah. For sure. One thing that, you know, when reading your description that you sent me, I mean, I couldn't help but smile when you were writing about fantasizing all day about eating an Ezekiel muffin with peanut butter. Obviously, the entire context was nothing to laugh about, but I kind of like giggled a little bit when I saw that, because I'm thinking to myself, like, is that what you typically crave? And Ezekiel muffin? And I mean, the horrible part was like, you couldn't eat it for multiple reasons. And that was sad. Your husband like snuck out of the room to like give it to you and all this thing. But yeah, is that like your normal craving? Like, where did that come from?
That's a pretty standard, like, yeah, that's in the repertoire.
Sure.
Like a frequent flyer for sure. Yeah, it was really funny because I wasn't allowed to eat for whatever, but that was the one all haze. And I just all things, but that was the one thing I remember that I kept perseverating on, was like, I'm hungry.
Oh man, that sucks.
Yeah.
So at what point were you able to start eating normally again? Like, your face didn't hurt anymore and everything.
So, as soon as I got clear that I didn't need surgery, which was, I don't know, maybe 30 hours after the accident, something somewhere in that range. I guess they just like, they went through the third set of CAT scans and they determined that like the bleeding was occurring at a rate at which the brain could reabsorb it. And like,
Got
I was
it.
At risk of like my brain filling up. And needing to relieve the pressure. So then I was allowed to eat, and they sort of said, you can eat completely normally as tolerated.
Good. Okay.
But it was like soft foods for a little bit.
Yeah. I imagine you must have been in quite a bit of pain.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Glad you're okay and on the road to recovery. And I think you said you even started running again. Is that right?
Yeah. So it was really awesome. Last Monday was my first day back that I was cleared to run. And it feels absolutely I think some of the sense of just like life appreciation, and that obviously umbrellas out to running, because it's so dear to my heart, is like just really vivid and present since the accident. So like, it's just felt so amazing. I mean, my fitness has definitely taken a big hit, I sort of don't care. Just like, I'm out there and it's great.
What did you have lined up for this, the rest of the season? Like, were you kind of done after Eastern States? Did you have a bunch of stuff lined up for the fall?
Yeah. So thankfully that was the planned end of the race.
Okay. Good.
Sort of privately, I had been toying with the idea of running Cat's Tail, depending on how my recovery went from Eastern, which is actually this coming weekend. And I'm going to sweep the first 10 miles. So that'll be fun.
Okay. But,
there were no big plans for the fall, which I also feel really grateful for that this happened at this time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, let's now rewind and dive into your nutrition roots, because this is where, you know, it all starts. And it's really interesting to hear about where my guests kind of came from in that sense. So yeah, talk to me a little bit about what you remember about nutrition, your childhood. And as I often kind of phrase it, you know, what the food scene was like in your house growing up.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was actually a really good food scene in some respects. My mom cooked most nights of the week, and we always sat down. I have one brother, he's about 7 years older. So we always sat down and made like a thing of eating. And my grandparents on my maternal side were like really passionate about food. And from a really early age, I have pretty vivid memories of like certain things that they would make. And I guess there was just a culture of loving food and appreciating food. You know, I remember my mom letting me like taste a drop of coffee in my milk or a drop in my water, like from, you know, probably kindergarten or something.
Yeah.
There's like a culture of appreciating.
Awesome. Did things change at all kind of as you became a teenager, or not really? Are there any kind of transitions or things that stuck out to you in your memory about food and body and all that kind of stuff?
Definitely. I think that becoming a teenager, and probably even more so like a young adult, young 20s, mid 20s, definitely struggled with body image issues, and I like food lost some of its pleasurable connotation for a period of years. You know, I would actually even say maybe starting in later childhood.
What do you think was the kind of stimulus for that?
Oh God, that's a great question. You know, I wish I had a concrete answer. I'd say that my earliest memory of it, I did some acting as a kid, and I remember like being in a waiting room to audition for a part of a drowning extra in Baywatch. And I'm like, I think I was like 5 or 6 at the time.
Oh, wow.
And, I remember looking at another girl in the waiting room and thinking like, oh, she's, and this is, I like know how sort of sad and pathetic this is saying it, like there's self-awareness here, but, remember thinking like, oh, she's more blonde and more skinny than I am. So she'll definitely get this part. And like that, you know, that was age 6. So like where that stuff, how it kind of congealed and materialized, I don't know, but it was in there for sure. You know, just sort of osmosis from being out in the world.
I feel like kids pick up all kinds of stuff. I mean, my daughter's only 4.5 and maybe it's from watching too many Disney movies, or I don't know, but like she wears glasses and she doesn't think the glasses are beautiful and she needs to wear her hair. So, I mean, it's, you know, 'cause she doesn't see Disney princesses with glasses and things like that.
Yeah.
It's like kids get all kinds of stuff from all over, but yeah. Oh, that breaks my heart to hear that. Okay. And go ahead.
I think it's good to, you know, a lot of this stuff like doesn't get talked about all that much. And I think that it's like great for people to be open about it and just so that other people can kind of recognize like, oh, they're not alone in this kind of having been through some similar ideation, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I read actually in the Ultra Running Magazine article that you, you know, were featured in that you used to be a competitive equestrian show jumper. When was that happening in this whole situation? So was that when you were young?
Yeah, it was a huge part of my life. So, age like 3 to 10, I was
three.
Like, passionate. Well, this is precursor. I was like super passionate about ballet and dance, the belly in particular. And then I got on a horse when I was about 10 and like that was it. I just fell in love with it. And I started riding and then I started competing shortly thereafter and did that until I was pregnant with Vladimir, who's now 6.
Oh, wow. So you were jumping up until that point. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But I loved it. I was really passionate about it. It's a really exciting sport. Yeah.
Do you still do it at all? Or have you kind of just fully transitioned to ultra running?
Oh, well, it's so funny because I always sort of like dab and like in a very, very, very light and not competitive sense, but would just go and putter around horse up until a few months ago when we were in New Hampshire for the summer. But now I'm thinking like, oh God, I should probably refrain from getting on a horse for the next 6 months or something.
Just oh, yeah.
I don't necessarily want to get another bang to the head. But yeah, it was always something and I taught my son to ride. And I think it'll always be a part of my life in some capacity.
Talk to me about kind of, I'm not really familiar with that sport very much, but talk to me a little bit about kind of how that changed your view of, you know, nutrition and fueling yourself and all that, because I mean, it is a sport. It is still like, you have to be aware of how you feed yourself and your position, your body and all that stuff. So yeah, I don't know. Was that kind of on your mind at all? You know, just kind of, I mean, I realize the spans a huge period of time in your life. Yeah. If you started at age 10 and you only stopped 6 years ago, but maybe talk to me a little bit about that journey and, you know, what kind of changes were taking place.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think that unlike sports where there's like a really obvious benefit, you know, a power to weight ratio, like those bucket of sports, equestrian sports, for sure, there's going to be a benefit to the horse for having an athlete with, you know, not an excessively high body weight. But it's not something that actually is very talked about. And if you look even at the Olympic level, like it doesn't look like there's a lot of, there's a really wide range of bodies. So I never kind of felt pressure from within the sport to look a certain way or to, you know, maintain an extremely low body weight. There are some disciplines of horseback riding, like jockeys, where that to play. But thankfully, it wasn't this. That being said, I do think that there is like the perfectionism. Like I intended to go to the Olympics for equestrian sport. And I think that there's sort of just like a type A and an obsessiveness and a perfectionism that can kind of leech over into one's nutrition. But it didn't come from like pressure.
Yeah.
From the sport itself, if that makes sense.
Sure. I mean, talk to me about kind of your Olympic dreams in there. And was it like you were on the road to the Olympics or trying to get to the Olympics and then you got pregnant? Or was it kind of at that point no longer part of the plan? Or what kind of was happening there?
Yeah, I think that by the time I got pregnant, I saw like that road isn't going to happen. I think I sort of was like neither. People who are super successful in that sport either have like a tremendous, tremendous talent and work ethic or a tremendous wallet. And like, I had neither. I had none of the above. So I had sort of relinquished the dreams to that level, but still hoped to compete as like a very high level amateur, or professional. But you know, when I got pregnant with my son, I think I really thought like a lot about the culture of the sport and sort of the people in the sport and the spiritual aesthetic of it. And I thought, you know what? I don't feel at home in that milieu. And like, I don't really want to raise my son in it. It's like the sport itself is so thrilling, but the culture surrounding it is a little bit like homogenized and narrow. It just ultimately, I was like, it's time to let this go.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I love horses, and I, like, when I was a kid, we used to go to these summer camps, and we'd do like vaulting and jumping. Fun. And then we would, it was so fun. And we would do, we used to go to like this dude ranch in California. It was like kind of, we would do like more like Western style riding and just galloping on horses. I mean, I just have so many amazing memories with horses, but my experience is pretty limited to that. And I haven't gotten a horse in so long, but it's definitely one of those things I feel like would be really fun to do again. But as a sport, I don't have that much experience, just kind of more recreational. So it's interesting to hear about it. When did running and specifically ultra running really enter the picture here?
So it entered the picture when, Vladimir was about a year and a half old. Uh-huh. And it was completely random. Like I had transitioned out of one like extremely time consuming athletic pursuit. And also I had just graduated college and I went to Columbia. I studied like Indo-Tibetan stuff. So I had at that time, like a pretty committed sitting meditation practice. Yeah. And then, like, I have this new baby, and the last thing I want to do when I have free time is sit down. Like, I'm just like sitting and nursing him, and I'm so sick of being sedentary. And also, if I'm kind of in my house but not with him, like, I just hear him screaming.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh man, I just want to leave my house.
Relatable.
I'm sure. So I really started running as a way to like run away from my newborn and toddler. And at some point when I was just sort of puttering around, I'm talking like, you know, twice a week, like maybe 2 miles, if that. And I saw a sign for a half marathon that was that weekend. And I just thought, like, I'm going to do it. And I did. And it was a great experience. And I just sort of fell in love with it and got hooked. And I think, like, because I had, for my whole, like, teenage and young adult life, like, structured my life around an athletic discipline, albeit like a non-aerobic one, a technical one, but still like that idea of finding pleasure and meaning in sport was super ingrained. And so it sort of easily just fell upon this new target.
Oh, that's so cool. So you hadn't done any running at all up until that point?
I mean, like I would sprint race my brother when I was a kid on the boardwalk, you know, I would like, but no, I would like occasionally putter around, but no, nothing, you know, I maybe ran like 3 times a year before that.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. Cause I know that when we started working together, which I think was in 2018, you were fairly new to the sport, but you were starting to become a bit competitive, but nothing like you are now. So it was, or not quite at the level you are now. You were kind of like on the rise.
No, I think you're right. I think it was like brand new. Yeah.
You were very new to all that stuff.
Super and super new. Yeah.
Yeah. And now you're like crushing it, which is so cool. Okay. So I'm really interested to kind of hear more. I mean, we've kind of skipped over a bunch. I sense a lot under the surface in terms of kind of body image and food struggles and all of that, especially, you know, kind of when you were younger. So far before, you know, way before running entered the picture, do do you want to talk about any of that, or is there anything you, if there's anything you feel like you want to share?
I'm open to everything. Like, I feel like the only way that one can have a positive impact on other people's lives is by being candid about their own selves and history and struggles and all of that. So like, I have, there's no, you know,
I'm open. Sweet. Yeah. So I know, you know, when we started working together, you were running, you were doing the ultras, you're getting into all that stuff. And, you know, there was still that kind of body awareness, desire for weight loss, kind of self-consciousness present, which I know has changed now. You know, so now you're in a much different, more positive place that you shared with me, which is awesome. So yeah, I guess I'm kind of curious kind of what things were like prior to us meeting. And obviously you shared that with me privately, but I want you, I'm not at liberty to share that. So I would like you to share whatever you feel comfortable, kind of what your experience with food was like, and your attitude towards nourishing yourself, and just how you viewed it, you know, especially coming out of the situation you described with your family where food was pleasurable, that, you know, you all sat down and ate food and all of that, and then kind of you became aware of these struggles when you were quite young. So yeah, anything you'd like to kind of share along that journey up into the point where you, you know, we started working together and you started running and all of that?
Yeah. I guess it's been a really long journey. I mean, I can remember probably disordered eating. I would say subclinical eating disorder, but disordered eating and like disordered behavior and thinking around food and body image starting very young. And then in high school, probably starting to restrict food on some level. I also, at some point in there, like age 18, 19, I went to rehab for coke. So that's like, that was a mechanism of like restriction, or, you know, like a means to achieve like a certain body type, I think, for my adolescence. And then not having that as a young adult, I think I just turned to like just really strict restriction for a period of years. I mean, I remember like not having a normal period since age 18. This has been the first year that it has finally like come back regularly, which is like so exciting that I can't even like describe.
Yes. I remember we were working with that when, you know, when we were together. Yeah.
But, so just really, just disordered behaviors that were like essentially some degree of restriction and worrying and obsession, sort of like perseveration on the type, the, you know, degree or type of restriction.
Do you think, do you think that running kind of helped you get out of that in a way?
So much. So I think there are two interesting components of it. I think the first, hey Luna, is that just running and running long, you get really hungry. It sort of became unviable to ignore hunger cues that maybe, you know, when you're a student and you're sitting on a train and then you're sitting in class and you go home and you sit on a horse. Like when I had maybe a less active life, like those were a little bit easier to kind of push down. And then suddenly starting to run and it's like, oh, wait a minute. I really want to eat. It doesn't feel good to restrict. I think I also started to see from very early on that my fastest times and best performances actually had like an inverse correlation with body weight. And even though, you know, I'm an N of one and I have like a limited data set, but I still do have a fair amount of metrics around, you know, what I weighed and how I performed or what percentage or how good I felt, how fast I was, you know, my injury history. And I think over time, I really saw like, oh, wow, I'm faster and I'm more competitive when I'm not restricting food, like in any, you know, in any sense. So it took some years of that. I think, and then also just having really good role models of friends who loved food and loved to bake and loved to cook and loved to drink and just had a healthy relationship with nourishing oneself. So, yeah, so I think it was like both running and the people in it that kind of helped recalibrate that baseline.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and it's really interesting to hear and wonderful to hear that your success, you know, as an athlete, and obviously this is an ongoing process that you're on, but or that you're in, but that it has been independent of weight. And, you know, because as you know, so often we link it to weight and it's not all about that. So it's really nice to hear you actually say that.
Yeah. It's really fascinating. You know, I think that in a lot of sports and even in shorter distances and running, like you can draw a pretty direct correlation. But I think as the distances get longer and there is, you know, multiple, sometimes competing hypotheses on the reasons behind this, but there isn't as clear a correlation. And I've definitely found that to be true for myself.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's just like really liberating. It's liberating to shift the narrative from, how do I look or how do I want to look to how fast am I?
Yeah.
How competitive am I? Like, it's just, it's a really liberating shift.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd love to, for you to share a little bit more about your journey. I mean, maybe from a training perspective, actually, just, you know, again, to kind of go back to what we were saying before, when we were first working together a few, you know, handful of years ago, you were doing some races, but it wasn't just on the level that you were doing now. I mean, you, as we said, you finished sixth female at Eastern States 100. And I know that wasn't your goal. Your goal was to win it. You had some major challenges in that race, which, you know, you can also share. But I mean, sixth female is really amazing.
It was low down in the field. I didn't even actually look at the results, but I believe it was in like the lower half of the field. Like, it sounds good, but that actually was like a really poor performance.
Oh, really?
Thank you.
Well, I know you've won several races, like outright, or for, you know, first female, and you finished top 10 and everything I saw on Ultra Sign Up. So, I mean, you are performing pretty, you know, you're crushing it, dude. I think you are, especially compared to where you're at when we were working together. So, I know you still have a ways to go to get to what you want to achieve, which is great. Great to have those goals. But yeah, I mean, do you have any other kind of thoughts on what has led to your greater success in the years between, you know, since we last worked together and now?
Yeah. So I think I would say the biggest factor that we just really lucked out on is that there happens to be this huge and thriving ultra running trail and ultra community based out of the park on which our house is, like, on the perimeter.
Oh, so wow.
It's just a huge group of us. I mean, sometimes there'll be 40 people who come out on a Sunday to run. And these people have, like, become my best friends in the way that you have friendships in, like, middle school and high school, you know, just like sort of intense, really close relationships. And we're all kind of doing the same thing. So there was both, like, the logistical aspect of just, oh, there are so many people to run with. There are so many fast people to run with. There are people who have accomplished a lot. And the social aspect of it, I think, both definitely played into my kind of falling in love with the sport and also my having, like, a baseline of knowledge, or knowledge is too strong a word, but a baseline of mimicry. People who I could mimic until I started to accrue knowledge of what to be doing on my own.
In which park is this?
And this is Ward Pound Ridge.
Where is that?
It's in Pound Ridge, New York, and it's not huge. We have like about 35 miles of trails. It's, you know, there's nothing mountainous or like spectacular about it, but it's just really, really solid. moderately technical East Coast single track.
Nice.
35 miles of it. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Well, that sounds fantastic and fun. And there's nothing like supportive, amazing community to just like get you to really get going on something. So I'm all for that. That's great. That's so cool. And, but you were doing some stuff on your own, right? I mean, you've done some pretty major training runs and things by yourself. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say that the majority of the running I do is actually by myself.
Okay.
Especially so 2 summers ago, I started to go up to the Whites in New Hampshire a lot and just kind of like sleep in my car and go and train. And then this year we lived up there, and we will in subsequent summers. And that was actually really nice too, just to have a block of time where I was forced to really be solo, and navigate solo and be responsible for my safety and kind of like all the variables. That felt really beautiful and empowering.
Yeah. To me. You mentioned safety. Talk to me about kind of risk. And I'm not sure if you heard my interview with Hillary Allen. That wasn't too long ago.
Yeah, but I'd love to.
Yeah, she's amazing.
So amazing.
So we were kind of talking about risk and, you know, appetite for risk and or tolerance for risk, you know, especially after an injury. And obviously your injury is not in any level to her injury that she suffered, which was insane. But still, like, you had a bad crash, and I mean, it's terrifying. It's terrifying, right? And I wonder if, I don't know. And I was reading about some other training experiences you've had out in the mountains where it's also like there were some close calls and it was pretty scary. And yeah, I wonder kind of what your thoughts are on that, especially as a mom, as a wife, you know, and just for yourself, if you had any thoughts on safety.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's a great question. And it's definitely one that has come up for me a lot more since the accident. As that was something that the severity was preventable. You know, I probably still would have had a bad day, but I probably wouldn't have walked away with hemorrhaging and whatever had I been wearing a helmet. So this is definitely a work in progress. I have always found that, I mean, I'm not super averse to risk. I'm not maybe like fearful of certain situations in the way that people close to me are, but this feels kind of natural and normal to me. But the consequence is that I have had some really close calls in the mountains. And looking back, they were all stuff that's like, oh, I should have just had a touch more gear, or I should have just turned around, you know, like I knew the weather was bad. Again, so sort of like preventable close calls. So I actually, after this accident, reached out to one of my best friends, who's actually also an ultra runner. He also ran Manitou's in Eastern States this year. And he's a psychologist at a local college, and just asked him, you know, hey, like, help me. Like, I don't have this fear that's kicking in to guide decisions. So like, help me come up with some sort of steps that I can use alternatively to evaluate risk, especially if I'm going to be in the mountains or it's winter or I'm going to be solo or whatever. So just like establishing a framework for guiding decisions in the absence of like the fear that does that automatically for other people.
That's so fascinating. Yeah, I definitely cannot relate to that. I need like the opposite. I need someone to like kick me in the butt and be like, just get out there.
Oh my God.
But I mean, I think there's a benefit to, in some ways, to not having that fear, right? To push you to do really incredible things. But yes, obviously, at a certain point, we want to be very careful. We want to make sure we're being smart about it. I think as Hillary had said, like, there's always risk in the mountains. Like, you can't go out there and never have any risk. Like, it's a risky sport. And it's a dangerous sport, but can at least be somewhat smart about it and take certain precautions. Right. So, okay, good. Let's talk about becoming a mom. I'm going to jump around a little bit, and I want to get back to like training and what a day looks like and your sports products and all that good stuff. But I just, for a brief moment, want to talk about becoming a mom, because you have a 6-year-old son, Vladimir. Yeah. I know how challenging pregnancy and postpartum and just simply being a parent is, I mean, it's so freaking hard. And it's hard on your body. It's hard on your ability to train and compete. It's hard on mental health. It's hard to balance. What would you like to share about your experience becoming a mom? You know, how it's impacted your identity, your success as an athlete, all of that good stuff.
Yeah. So it is, I love what you said. Like it's super hard and it's also relentless and it never goes away. You don't have sort of a cessation from it. Somebody described it to me once as like the longest break you get is when you shut the passenger car door and you walk around to the driver's side. Like that's your big break in parenting. And it's interesting because I never assumed that I would have children. I had like a gay best friend as a young adult, and we sort of said like, "Oh, we'll have a kid, and you can raise it." I imagined like far, but then when I met my husband, it was super important to him to have a kid. And so we ended up sort of meeting in the middle and having one. And it's been a fascinating journey. I think I feel lucky in that Vladimir is like this gentle, beautiful flower. Like he's a really easy kid. He's really loving. He's really sweet. But that being said, I think that I take a lot of like solace in being able to go out in the mountains and go out and train and have some times of separation, sometimes that are days, and that just gives me like fresh energy and sort of enthusiasm for, you know, whatever, like a book about construction equipment or like whatever it is that we're doing.
Yeah. How amazing that you have that time. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's incredible to kind of watch him become more of his own person and fall in love. He like has a crush this year in first grade. Aww. He talks about her constantly. And yeah, it's really, really cool.
Does he ever run with you?
Yeah, he does. So some months ago, he said that he wanted to start training. So I had him like draw out a training plan for himself, which is basically like him running 3 days a week. So for a period of months, we were on a pretty good train. We did a bridge to bridge, which is like a 1.1 mile loop. And we did it several times a week and he loved it. And then that when we moved, that sort of fell out, but I took him hiking a lot. And
that's awesome.
That was really fun. We go about 1 mile per hour. And there's a lot of like snacks involved. But
Does your husband run as well?
Yeah, he does. He does. He's done some really cool stuff himself, and he's definitely like less of like an obligate runner. He likes it. He loves it. He doesn't love it as much, but he gets out there and trains and races.
Awesome. All right, let's get back to the nutrition. I would love to hear what kind of a typical eating day looks like for you right now, or if not right this moment, because things are still a little funky with your recovery, maybe kind of at the height of your training.
Yeah, it's funny. I'd say the eating definitely differs in like this sort of transition phase and down phase versus the height of training. And usually just because of like, I mean, not just the difference in training load, but I'd say even more so the difference in available time. Mm-hmm. So this time of year is like the really fun time for getting to cook and make kind of more elaborate things or lunches that take a while and whatnot. So like right now, a typical day is, should I just run through?
I mean, maybe first start with like, you know, do you eat all things? Are there any restrictions in your diet? Just kind of run through what a day looks like.
So I'm like the most sort of bullshitty, like loose vegan that you can possibly be. Like, I am like I cook vegan. If I'm making food for myself, it's vegan. But if I go to a race like mile 80, like I'm going to eat bacon or bacon pizza or what, like I'm going to eat anything that appeals.
Sure.
And one of my best friends in the world is like this amazing baker. So also anything that he bakes, I will eat like without any hesitation.
How long have you been vegan for, or quasi-vegan?
I think it started when I was at Columbia and like studying Indo-Tibetan stuff.
Okay.
That's when the seeds of it kind of started. So I was like 21, 20. So yeah, about roughly 12 years. But they've been very much on and off. And like if I try, if I go to Italy, like I'm going to eat whatever. So it's like really, really loose.
Got it.
Because I just like, I love food and I love like experiences. Yeah. Yeah, but at home, but so when I cook and just make food for myself, it's typically vegan. You
know? Okay. So yeah, talk to me about kind of what that day looks like typically, or what a day could look like.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, I'll just do today, which is pretty typical. So breakfast and lunch are usually the same every day. Breakfast, I made like oatmeal with blueberries, tahini, molasses,
yum,
ginger, cinnamon, cardamom, turmeric. Like big bowl, like really spicy, really sweet, really warm.
And that's before lunch.
Yeah. I like coffee and like lots of coffee. I typically find that I just do better if I run fueled. I have like no aptitude for, I don't know. I just feel like the quality is always going to be so much higher for me. So unless I'm doing like a really short duration recovery effort, I'm going to fuel beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then what?
So then lunch is like usually a big salad, but it kind of changes throughout the year, just depending on what's available. And I also, we grow food a little bit.
Oh, nice. What do you grow?
Oh my God, this year. So we had friends living in our house here. He was actually my classical Tibetan professor from Columbia. And like lived here while we were up in New Hampshire. But like we had butternut squash, tomatoes, Swiss chard, basil, cucumbers, raspberries, strawberries, all sorts of stuff.
Amazing. I just started a vegetable garden in May because we're staying at my parents' house. And so we have all the space now that we're in California. I'm obsessed. I have no idea what I'm doing, like literally no idea. But I'm having so much fun growing stuff. It's awesome. Isn't it so fun? It's so fun.
Yeah. And I feel like it's so beautiful to show your kids and that they have an understanding of like, oh my God, like food grows. And
my 1-year-old loves picking stuff. Although she sometimes picks things that are really not supposed to be picked. Trying to teach her, no, only pick the ripe tomatoes. No, but oh yeah, she loves to pick the green beans and the tomatoes and sometimes the flowers. But you know, it's great. It's so great with kids. It's awesome.
It's so cute.
Okay, so you're cooking with all your goodies, which is wonderful.
Yeah. So it'll just be like a trough of like, you know, usually some beans, like some butternut squash or sweet potato seeds or nuts. I love like just buying the pre-cooked packaged beets in like the cold section of the supermarket, throwing some of them in there, apples this time of year, stuff like that. It would be awesome. Just, it's really big, beautiful cornucopia.
Sure. Okay. And then what's next?
So dinner. So I actually made this earlier because I knew that we're going to be chatting. So tonight I made like a broccoli faux cheddar soup, and it's really good. It has like a lot of coriander. It has some pepper in it, and I'll make like a finishing oil, maybe some seeds, some corn, And then I bought like a nice whole wheat sourdough bread, just like that, toasted with olive oil.
What's the faux cheddar part? Like, is it just like non-dairy cheese?
It's a cashew base.
Okay.
It was a surprise. It was like 3/4 of a cup of cashews. So like really kind of creamy, and then nutritional yeast. And
okay. Got it.
That's
got it.
Where you get sort of that, the, like,
okay, that makes sense.
Maybe you could pass for cheese.
Yeah.
Like if you were not observant. Yeah.
Do you miss cheese at all or other things ever?
So I don't get to the point of missing, because if there's something I want to eat, I'll eat it.
Got it.
Like if I just feel like life is really short, and also like I love food, and I love to eat. I care about food. So like if I have a craving for something, also there is a function too of often like finishing a really long training run in a remote area, there's not going to be a lot of food options available. So like
sure,
dinner might be like a slice of pizza or whatever. And like in those cases, it's fine. Like it's what's there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Are you having a snack at any point, like in between lunch and dinner? Is that where the Ezekiel muffin with peanut butter falls in?
Oh yeah. Actually, that's so funny. Yeah. I usually will have an Ezekiel muffin. Usually like I'll eat lunch kind of late, and I'll eat that with peanut butter, olive oil, like as I'm cooking.
Got it.
Just to sort of stave off hunger. Yeah.
Okay. Any other kind of like typical things you might have in your days, especially like high volume training times?
So high volume training, I'm not going to be cooking to that extent.
Got it.
Just as a function of time. So there's going to be a lot more like Thai food takeout, like mm-hmm. asking for 2 extra orders of white rice. Like there's just going to be like a lot more calorically dense volume. And so like breakfast will always kind of be the same. And then often lunch will get lost because you're fueling during the run.
Yeah.
And dinner will just be more things like, you know, pasta and olive oil and veg, just sort of like the easiest, most calorically dense, like comfort foods around the higher volume training.
And let's talk about that fueling during your runs. What does that look like? What kind of products are you using? What kind of foods are you packing for your training runs or reaching for in races? Talk us through a little bit of that.
Yeah. So it's interesting. During the warm season and while racing, I typically like to use just a carbohydrate solution if I have the ability to do so. I think that there are a lot of really excellent reasons for what Stacey Sims would call keeping your calories in your pocket and your hydration in your bottle, like, you know, for separating your caloric source or carbohydrate source from your hydration. But I personally just find that it works really well for me. Mm-hmm. I think that the drawbacks to it occur more in the winter when you're at risk of not drinking enough to provide you with an adequate carbohydrate source. But I think that in the summertime, it's really easy to just supplement with water or ginger or whatever. So I find that that's less of an issue, especially if you're going to be at a race with relatively frequent aid stations.
Can you kind of, you know, go into a little bit more detail about what you mean when you say a carbohydrate solution, just like a sports drink, you mean?
Yeah. So like guroctane is something that, mm-hmm. I personally, it works really well for me, but people will use Tailwind. There are mm-hmm, a bunch mm-hmm. of, you know, Morton, like drink
okay.
mixes that have, you know, 250 to 300 sure. plus calories per, you know, 20-ish ounces of water.
So you're saying that you're using just that in an entire race and then just like eating some things off the table?
Exactly. Yeah. So I'll eat off the table. So like that will be my primary fueling plan. And then typically around 100K, when you just start to degrade both mentally and physically. And like, then I'll eat off the table more as like a point of just interest, just something to like a carrot to look forward, a proverbial carrot to look forward to at the next aid station. I'll kind of pick at food off the table And sometimes at that time, I'll also switch my drink calorie source from like a sports nutrition product to just Coke, and then just do that as like Coke as the primary calorie source for the remainder of the race.
Got it. And when you're kind of training on your own, like when you're doing these really long training efforts solo, what kinds of things are you packing for yourself, you know, other than the carbohydrate drink?
Oh, so one thing that is super, super cool about the White Mountains is that there are a series of huts. I believe there are 8, and they are all like these high alpine, just almost like aid stations. I mean,
it's incredible.
So you can sleep there, you can eat meals there, you can, I mean, they'll give you butterfly stitches if you need. Like, they're really just these like magical oases of like people in their young 20s who somehow have had the foresight to like do this instead of like drink themselves to oblivion for a few years. And it's just amazing. And there you can get, they always have baked goods. And I mean, they'll sometimes have like vegan pizza. They'll have, you know, jerky. They just have all kinds of stuff. So often over the summer, it was really fun because I could just pack, you know, essentially like guroctane drink mix and just hit up the huts as like an aid station if I wanted to.
That's so interesting. So like people live there? How does that even work?
Yeah. So there's a small handful of like young adults live there and caretake. And they're also often like really amazing runners. Like usually when you see someone who looks like in the white, it's like, wow, that person's a really good runner. And then like often you would see them in a hut later, like working there. Yeah.
That's so cool. So what a great place to train. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, and like outside of the whites, and I would be packing, it sort of depends like on the, if it's just going to be a low day intensity and maybe with friends and I know there's going to be hiking, like, yeah, I'll pack some real fall pack PB&J or like gnocchi is something I love. Some kind of more real foods, but and that stuff I'll eat a lot. Just during the more casual, like especially during the fall, if I do longer stuff when I'm more time distant, like removed from a race and don't have to worry about practicing as much, I'll be a little looser.
I see, like for the most part, you've kind of stuck to East Coast races. Are you trying to kind of get out and do some other stuff at some point, do you think? Or are you, you enjoy the East Coast stuff the most?
No, you know, it's so funny. So this year, actually, I've had a lot of time in the past like 6 weeks to think about what I want to do next year. And I actually picked out my calendar. So the first race, which really hinges on my ability to resume training without an increase in, you know, TBI symptoms would be, ideally would be Trans Gran Canaria, which is in March. And the other kind of big race of the year would be either the 100K at Val d'Aran, or which is in the Pyrenees in July, or the 100K at Eiger. So, and then I decided to do so those would kind of be the 8 races, and then as just build up races that I would wrap into training as opposed to have a full cycle and taper for. I want to do Breakneck Marathon and then in the spring, and Cat's Tail Marathon in the fall, which are both like pretty technical trail marathons.
Now, would the whole family come on the bigger trips, or would you leave them home?
Yeah. it was so funny in my mind when I first thought about Trans Gran Canaria, I was like, you know what? Who knows what the international travel scene will be like. And you know, Vladimir technically has school then. And I thought like, I'm just going to sneak off and go by myself. And then as soon as I like broached the idea, like she's like, oh great. Like, you know, just pull Vlad from school. And I was like, oh, okay. Family.
so much for running away from your family.
Oh my God. Oh my God. But I'm actually like so excited. Like he's in an age now where it would be super, super fun. And then he also has 2 weeks of spring break a week after. So part of me is like, you know what? I just want to pull him for a month and just, we're going to be out there and just take him around Europe and do whatever. So we'll see how it ends up playing out. But I'm actually really excited for that.
That sounds pretty epic. Yeah. I hope it all works out.
Thank you. Yeah.
What challenges do you still face with your nutrition? What do you think kind of could still use some improvement or further tweaks?
So I think definitely like the amount of sodium during races. I found, and this hasn't happened every race, but intermittently, I found like that I'll have a crazy amount of water retention during the race. And it seems like very, very difficult to know whether that's from excess sodium or insufficient sodium. And oddly enough, my intuition hasn't been that helpful. Like when I'm experiencing that, I'll always ask myself like, oh, you know, are you craving bacon or are you craving water? And there's never like a really clear answer for that. Yeah. So I would love to flesh that out because I think it would just be, really like, it's one of those variables I can improve moving forward. And I was actually curious to like maybe get a sodium sweat concentration test that I was going to look into. You know, I have no idea if this is like a $50 thing or like a $800 thing, but
yeah,
that's something that I know could definitely be fleshed out.
Yeah. I mean, sweat rates and sweat and salt losses are so variable and individual. And there's such a huge range. So that's something that's very tricky. And obviously it's affected by the environment that you're in as well.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things where it's like, yes, you can like taste something and think, oh, is that like, ooh, that salty potato chip tastes delicious? Or it's like, ugh, you know? Yeah. I know for myself, like when we did a Sean O'Brien recently, yeah, it was super fun. But like, you know, boiled potatoes, salt, pretty standard aid station fare, which is always delicious. But I remember dipping in salt and just being like, oh my God, that is like, I can't have salt. Like, it's just so gross. It tastes
so gross.
But it doesn't necessarily, it's hard to tell though, if like you've had too much salt, because also just like plain salt tastes gross. I don't know, at least to me.
Yeah.
If it's like too much of it, but like a salty potato chip was like the most delicious thing in the world. So, I think it just depends, you know? And the other thing of course to look out is for if you're feeling like nauseous, if you've had too much, but then again, you can be nauseous for other like 20 reasons. So, like,
right.
It can be hard to pinpoint these things without kind of getting it tested. And, they do have tests out there. I think, what is it? Levelin is the one that's been out there for a while. Gatorade just came out with a sweat patch, I believe.
I saw that. I was really
curious.
Efficacy.
I haven't tried that one personally. I haven't tried either of them. I think the level, I think that's what it's called. That one has been around for a while longer. It's not cheap, but it's maybe $100 or something like that. It's not, I have to look it up, but don't quote me on anything I'm saying. But,
yeah.
I mean, I don't think Gatorade's like cheap either, but it's certainly affordable. I think it's like less than $100 or around $100. Yeah. A client of mine did try it. So I mean, it's something that's worth giving a shot if you're curious on kind of seeing the numbers on it and you know, testing it out. But I find salt tricky, even as, you know, a sports dietitian. It's one of those things that is, I mean, tricky for my to figure out for myself sometimes. Okay. Anything else? You feel like everything else is pretty much dialed in?
I think probably, interestingly, like, I'd say the biggest focus in nutrition is like, just because of my history and because of like experiencing and recalling struggles in body image from such a young age, is creating a really positive and healthy environment for Vlad.
Yeah.
Because I think this stuff does actually affect men too. Even though 100%. They're maybe a little bit less vocal about it. But I think just from, you know, personal conversations and whatever, and some people who have been vocal on social media. So I felt so joyful this year when like there was a garden club at his school and he wanted to be in it. And he like brought home some potatoes and carrots and like wanted to roast them and, you know, eat one carrot raw. So I want him to have like the love and connection to food and to feeding people and like food as an act of love. And hopefully save him from some of the other stuff.
Yeah. So
that, you know, it's sort of like a daily practice. It's like an ongoing thing.
For sure. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Veronica, for sharing all this with me. I really appreciate you being so open about, you know, your whole nutrition story and sharing about your experience recently, which thank God went okay and you're on the mend. As you know, I like to wrap up these interviews with my quick bites question. So we will dive right into that. What is your favorite meal or snack when in a hurry? And I think I know the answer.
Yeah, you've got it. Totally. Yeah. Although I'm really like, I really can't, it's like picking between like when people have two kids, like your favorite kid or whatever. Like, I don't know if it's a Ezekiel muffin with like a lot of olive oil and salt or a lot of peanut butter. Like
I'll have to try the olive oil and salt. That does sound pretty tasty.
It's I haven't done good. That. Yeah.
Yeah. And favorite meal or snack when you're not in a hurry?
That would be breakfast. Like that's my favorite food on the planet.
Your oatmeal?
Yeah.
Nice. What is your favorite post-race meal?
Oh God, it's so varied. Like there have been post-races when like I want miso broth and nothing else. And then I remember after my first 100, like nothing looked appealing and someone had put a menu in front of me and there was like a brownie sundae plate to share. And I was like, yes, like that's it. and that just like felt like the most like nourishing, like best food experience. So it really, really varies. Sometimes food it's like my body's so sick of consuming stuff
that like for sure.
Yeah.
Biggest cooking catastrophe.
So I'm really a huge fan of the Vitamix, but there have been, you know, some times when I didn't put the lid on all the way.
And oh no.
Some pretty spectacular art like exhibitions that have gone up on the walls. And
oh my God. That happened to me once and it got on the ceiling and oh, that was just the worst.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh Lord. Most bizarre or exotic food that you've ever tried.
I remember my mom eating rattlesnake once when we were at like this game restaurant. But I always had like pet snakes growing up. Personally, that's a really good question. I have a good one. It was sea urchin pizza that I had in Sicily.
Oh.
Sea urchin is sort of like pureed, almost like you would get it in sushi, but it was like pureed as a topping.
Huh. Oh, wow. Was that good?
It was amazing.
Food in Sicily is pretty delicious. So
yeah,
but delish. What is your favorite beverage?
Oof. Not during the training, like during heaviest training, I usually just like don't have an appetite for drinking so much. But as soon as the heaviest training is over, Citizen Cider, either traditional, semi-dry, or the Dirty Mayor, which is like ginger infused.
Ooh, that sounds really good. I love ginger.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. What are your comfort foods? What foods remind you of growing up?
I would say, oddly enough, like I'd say white rice and miso soup are probably the two most like basic comfort, you know, on your deathbed or meal on death row.
Yeah. Foods. Okay. What's your favorite ice cream flavor?
Oof. I would say chocolate and vanilla swirl.
Nice.
with rainbow sprinkles.
Yum.
Yeah.
And last question, top three items of gear that are most essential to your active lifestyle.
I mean, shoes would definitely be number one. pair running sneakers.
What brand do you wear?
I wear Ultra. I recently have been wearing the Olympus, which are like a little more max cushioned than I typically am used to, but they have that Vibram outsole, which just like worked really well in the whites when you just,
nice.
It was just more technical terrain. You want more grip.
Yeah.
So I'd say that's number one. And I say number two is the car, because like I sleep a lot in my car. Like I put the back seats down.
Nice.
And probably number three would be my sleeping bag, which goes in the car.
Great. Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you again so much, Veronica. It was so much fun catching up with you. It's been too long. And it was so fun, like seeing you like pop up in my Instagram feed. I was like, oh my God, I know her. I was like, you're just crushing it. So I'm really glad I was able to get you on the show so quickly. So thanks again for your time today. And I hope everything works out for, you know, your upcoming racing season next year. So I can't wait to hear all about it.
Thank you. And I'm hopefully going to be in California like somewhat soon. So I'm going to reach
out. Well, definitely reach out. I don't know if I can keep up with you. Maybe I can, but I would love to. Take you to Redwood. All right. Have a good one. Thanks, Veronica.
All right, you too. Ciao.
That wraps up our show for today. Thank you again, Veronica, for your time and for sharing your story with us. I wish you the best of luck in your upcoming racing season. And I hope that the remaining months of 2021 bring you some additional recovery and rest that you need to feel strong for next year. Guys, as always, I ask you to rate and review the podcast if you haven't already, or share with friends. I really want to get the word out. I know I don't have a very consistent output at this point, but I'm still trying to get the word out as much as I can. So any help that you can put in, since the show is free, I would really appreciate it. Otherwise, you know where to reach me if you ever have any questions, comments, feedback, anything at all. eatforendurance@gmail.com. And you can find me on Facebook and Instagram at eatforendurance. Until next time, guys, have a good one.